Okay.
One page.
Yeah, so let's see. So I was telling somebody, I think maybe I'll go back a parak earlier, see if I get away with it. It saves me preparation. But if you want to know the truth, we're at Perek Yud Beis. We're up to Pasuk Gimel. But let's just back up for a moment to, so to speak, reset the stage. Okay, the Perek Yud Beis begins after the death of Shlomo HaMelech. And Rechavam is now the son taking over. And we are seeing the unfolding of the Nevuah of Achya HaShiloni, and that the Melucha will be split. So Rechavam went to Shechem, because there was a great assembly in Shechem, gathered Laham L'choso. And Chazal point out that Shechem was a place that was Mesugol, set aside for negativity for Piranius. And that took place in Shechem, the splitting of the Melucha. And what also happened at that time, Yerovam ben Nevat, who had run away to Egypt, heard of the death of Shlomo. Nevertheless, he remained in Egypt until he was called. But the people of the Shvatim called him, and he ended up joining this assembly. Pasuk Gimel. Vayishlechu vayikru vayavo Yerovam v'chol kahal Yisrael. And they sent and they called for him, and Yerovam and all of kahal Yisrael came. Vaydabru el Rechavam lehem, and they spoke to Rechavam, saying. Now in the previous pasuk, we already said that Rechavam came ki shem ba lahamlech. And then here we say vayishlechu vayikru vayavo. So we call Kal Yisrael. The first place says they were there. Now Pasuk Gimel says we called them. What happened? So the Mefarshim say that the Kal Yisrael was there, but they weren't participating in the discussions with Rechavam. Only the leadership met with Rechavam. Some of the leaders met with Rechavam, perhaps his officers, to discuss their problems, and they didn't get any place. The meetings were not productive. So at that point, the leaders called Kal Yisrael. They wanted to have a show of force. They called Yerovam, called Kal Yisrael. They wanted to show Rechavam that they have the support of the people, and that they have Yerovam, who is certainly a potential counterpart to Rechavam, and he should take them seriously. So there was a series of, if you will, of political maneuvers going on. Now we mentioned earlier, if anybody remembers, that there is a machlokas mefarshim. This whole episode, was it staged, or did it happen? In other words, when they came, did they deliberately intend to set it up so that they would have an excuse to divide the melucha? Or they came with a sincere complaint. They had a complaint, there were too many taxes, or whatever it was. And they came hoping for a solution. And when it didn't work out that way, then it evolved into a machlokas. Those who learned that it's deliberate, then they say this whole thing was a setup. They came to Rechavam, called him to Shechem. Rechavam did not know that Yerovam was lurking in the wings. And they had these meetings. And then, all of a sudden, Yerovam and Kol Kal Yisrael shows up. So they had set the stage in such a way that they'd be able to make a confrontation. Why did they bring Yerovam? So the Mitzuda says that Yerovam had a track record of being fearless. And Yerovam maybe went overboard, but he wasn't afraid to criticize Shlomo, and he wouldn't be afraid to criticize Rechavam. The leaders of this group were afraid that people would chicken out. It's precedented. If you recall, Chazal tell us that when Moshe Rabbeinu came to Mitzrayim, and he was going to confront Paro, so he came with the Shivim Zakenim, with the 70 elders. As they marched towards the palace, they disappeared one by one. By the time he got there, it was just Moshe and Aaron. And as that result of that, when it came to Maimon Har Sinai, the Zakenim were left behind, and they were not allowed to ascend the mountain. They left behind, they stayed behind when Moshe went in the first time. They have to stay behind when Moshe went now. So it is certainly, there's often a difference between, you know, people talk tough amongst themselves, we're going to go, we're going to take on Rechavam, we're going to do this. And when it comes time to the confrontation, nobody has anything to say. So, therefore, they wanted to have Yerubbam because they knew Yerubbam was fearless and Yerubbam would carry forward with their agenda. So, Pasuk Dalet, what was their complaint? So, Pasuk Dalet, Avinu Hiksha Es Uleinu, Avichav, sorry, Hiksha Es Uleinu, your father made our burden very hard. V'atah, and you, atah now, hakel me'avodas avicha, lighten the burden of your father, hakasha, which is so difficult, u'me'ulay hakaven, his heavy yoke, asher nosan alein, which he put upon us, v'navdeka, and we will then be willing to serve you. Now, the Mefarshim note, if their complaint was that Shlomo HaMelech made their burden very heavy, why didn't they complain to Shlomo HaMelech? We don't find that there are any complaints in the time of Shlomo HaMelech. So, there are a couple of different approaches to this. One approach is, and some of us have learned, that in the time of Shlomo HaMelech, they felt it was worth it. They had to pay a lot of taxes and do a lot of work, but what did they get for it? They got a Beis HaMikdash. They got peace and prosperity. Everybody was wealthy. There was security. So, you know, you're getting your money's worth. My people complain about taxes because, you know, they don't necessarily have control of how the money is spent, and therefore they don't feel they're getting the money's worth. But everything is going great, you know, and they're doing a great job, and we have peace and prosperity and security. And you couldn't ask for more. We said before that gold was worthless, practically worthless. Everyone was rich. So, okay, so we have to pay some taxes. At the end of Shlomo's reign, things weren't going quite as well because of the chataim, and they started having trouble with the neighbors. There were some battles. There were some wars. So now people felt differently. So they're complaining about the burden of Shlomo, but it really only was in recent years that it began to bother them. And now that there's a new regime taking over, so they were hoping to do something about it. That's one approach. And the Rabag, I think Mitzudas, others learn like that. The Radak has an interesting approach. Radak says this is all min hashamayim. All these years they're paying the same taxes and didn't bother anybody. All of a sudden, everyone's bothered by the taxes. Why? Because the Kadosh Baruch Hu planted this thought in their hearts and this feeling in their heads, because it was his means of carrying out his plan to divide the Malchus. But, you know, it's an interesting insight. We think we're making our own decisions in life, but we really can't be so sure. Sometimes we're being manipulated. In fact, the Chavos HaBavli says a very interesting thing. The Chavos HaBavli said, how do people choose their careers? If everybody in the world decided they wanted to be a tailor, we would have real tsaris. First of all, the tailors wouldn't make a living, right? Because there's so much competition, the prices would be dirt cheap. Everybody would be able to afford clothes, but you wouldn't have any food. Right, so people have to go into different professions. I often noted, you know, in the there was a period of time in Forest Hills that there were three quite wealthy people, all of whom were in the feather business. Different parts of the feather. I don't know if there is a feather business anymore. One of them was a feathers for ladies' hats. You don't see that anymore. Accessories, feathers for pillows. I'd like to know what child in elementary school, when you ask them, what do you want to do when you grow up, says, I want to go into the feather business. Who thinks of such things? Somehow ends up in the feather business, because you need feathers, you know, whatever. So the Chavos HaBavli says that Kadosh Baruch Hu plants ideas in the minds of people, what type of job they're going to take, what type, sometimes they have no choice, you know, it's how events direct them, so that the world has what it needs. Some people want to do this, some people want to do that. Now the people think they chose their careers. They think they chose their jobs. But it was all Minas Shamayim. I actually remember once we had a speaker in Florida speaking to the high school. And, you know, Rosh Yeshiva, very chashuv, he was a very good speaker. He was talking to them about this concept. So he gave an example. So he says, you know, how do people choose their careers? First of all, they're usually young. You know, they do it. They don't have any idea what to do. Some guy decides he wants to be a dentist. Does he have any idea what a dentist is? Whatever, he gets in his head, he wants to be a dentist. So in the meantime, there's this kid sitting like right in front of him, whose father's a dentist, and he's smiling, and then, you know, he says, dentist. Then he lowers the booms. In the meantime, the guy goes to dental school, gets good grades, becomes a dentist, and 30 years later, he's standing there sticking his hands in somebody else's mouth. And you got to realize one cavity is pretty much the same as any other cavity. And he may be thinking, why am I doing this? And you see this kid's face. Yes.
How do you reconcile this with the concept of
Bechira? Bechira has to do with spirituality, with right and wrong. So when it comes to choices that involve right and wrong, mitzvah and avera, then people make their own decisions. But when it comes to things that really don't, there's no right and wrong. There's no mitzvah to be a dentist as opposed to being, you know, a tailor or a businessman or this job or that job. Those are not right and wrong decisions. So those things are controlled by Kodesh Baruch Hu. In this particular case, your question is more appropriate because there is a right and wrong involved here. In a way, they're rebelling against Rechavam, against the king. This is an exception to the rule. This, according to the Radak, this is a case of something where they really didn't have the Bechira that they would normally have under such circumstances. So that would be a very important point regarding this story. So, but often we think we make decisions and we're really not. I have my own pet theory, although I must admit I have no proof for it. And I have not found anything in Chazal or Rishonim to support this, but nevertheless, I'll share it with you. I often wondered, you get individuals who get involved in particular chasadim. You know, this guy's into Tomchei Shabbos, and he lives and breathes Tomchei Shabbos. Guy's into Bikur Cholim. There's nothing else in the world but Bikur Cholim. You know, chickens for Israel, whatever it may be. People get very wrapped up in a particular chasadim. It's a wonderful thing. Now, to make the decision to get involved in a chesed is a bechira, is a free choice. But I wonder how they pick the individual chesed. Why is it, you know, this guy's into Hatzalah, this guy's into Tomchei Shabbos, this guy's into Bikur Cholim, this guy's into Hachnasas Kala. Now, sometimes there are things that happen in their lives that made them be more sensitive to this particular thing, but how does it happen? Is that bechira? I'm wondering if that's not the same thing as the Chavos HaVavos. A person could decide, I want to get involved in chesed. And if he decides he doesn't, that's bechira, because Yorach is not going to force him, you know, to do a mitzvah. But once he makes a decision, he wants to do a mitzvah, and he's sort of like, why is he end up directing this particular mitzvah? If everybody would do Tomchei Shabbos, where would the Bikur Cholim come from? So Kaisel has many needs. I'm wondering if it's not the same thing. Kodesh Baruch Hu, yeah, you want to talk to chesed? Great. You're my man. But right now I happen to need this particular thing. Right now I happen to need that particular thing. Somehow, you know, it directs things and picks that particular chesed. The guy says he doesn't want to do chesed. That's his bechira. Hashem's not going to make him do it. So I don't know, Rabosa. It's a theory I have. But yeah, masha yeah. The point here in the Radak is if you know, in this case, despite the fact that there's an element of right and wrong, nevertheless it was Minas Shamayim. And in general, where there's no element of right or wrong, very often the things that we think we're deciding, we're not deciding. So people agonize so much over career choices. Chill out a little bit, you know. If Hashem is directing you and making a decision for you, so you can make the same decision without you sweating and staying up 16 nights in a row, just as well as with you. So you might as well. Obviously you have to do your status and make an effort to be reasonable. But don't worry, in the end of the day, you're ending up where HaKadosh Baruch Hu is sending you, not where you think you're going. Now, we have some interesting terminologies in this pasuk. Let's take a look again. We find we find two terms in the pasuk, Uleinu and Avoda. Avicha Hikshes Uleinu V'haka Me'avodas Avicha Akasha V'na'avdecha. The Malbim explains that there's a little difference in implication between the word Avoda and all. Work is work. You could sign up, you could volunteer to work, work could be assigned. Work is a kind of a neutral phrase. But all is a burden. And all really comes from the yoke that you put on an animal. And the purpose of it is to force the animal to do what you want it to do, to go where you want it to go, to schlep what you want it to schlep. So the Malbim says a king could rule in two ways. One way a king rules is with, you might say, with input, with consultation. He talks to the Zakenim, he talks to the leaders, and he basically guides the country, but with a certain amount of consideration of what the people want. And there's a gavul, there's a boundary to what he will do. And something that the people really don't want, he may not do. That's somewhat semi-democratic. You could have a more autocratic king who does what he pleases and he doesn't care really and doesn't take into consideration how the people feel about it, and for that matter it could be he doesn't even take into consideration whether it's good for them or bad for them. He's got his own ambitions. He's got his own ideas. So all fits with the second approach. That he's a king that does what he pleases and he forces the people to follow him whether they like it or not. Says the Malbim that by David HaMelech did not rule that way. By David HaMelech had consultation, worked with the people. Shlomo was, that's why it says Avicha, your father, this doesn't go back two generations. He was Hikshas Uleinu. He forced Klal Yisrael to do what he wanted them to do. Not that he didn't take into consideration what was best for them. Shlomo Melech was not a despot and didn't do it for his own purposes. But Lamaisa, he forced them. He didn't give them a voice. It was taxation without representation. So this is what they were complaining about. Hiksha es uleinu. And whatever, again, during the time of Shlomo, they didn't complain, but now they are complaining. What they agreed to do is, if you hakel, if you lighten the burden, then na'avdecha, we will serve you, but we will not accept an all. We want you to go back to the old ways of David Melech, consult with us, input with us, we're willing to serve you, but we're not willing to accept an all. We're not willing to be forced where there is no, at least some degree of consensus amongst the people. That's the Malbim's approach. We also find a few other points here in the Pasuk. There are actually three references to the burdens that they have. Hiksha Suleinu number one, Hokya me avodas avicha, so avodas avicha is number two, and then Ume Ula HaKaveh, and the great burden, that's number three. So he said there were three problems that this is the Abarbanel, says there were three problems that Klal Yisrael had with Shlomo. One was the general taxes for the upkeep of the palace. Remember, we had before the description of the vast expenses involved in running the palace, and that was the one burden. The second burden was the justice of Shlomo HaMelech. We had many descriptions of his justice. Now, nothing particularly inherently wrong with that, but there's an interesting concept. We find a discussion in the Gemara in Sanhedrin. You know, before we get into that, let me just mention the third thing, and then we'll discuss it a little greater length. And the third was the burdens that were added when, towards the end of Shlomo's rule, when they started having military problems. So then they had to upgrade the military, and that was the third mass. People had to go into the army, they had to pay more money, whatever it may be. Now this idea that Shlomo was very demanding in his justice, And Shlomo was able to do it because he was a chacham mikol adam, and he could figure out who was right and who was wrong. There's a discussion in the Gemara in Sanhedrin, whether which is preferable, din or pshara, to follow justice or to make compromises. And actually, the halacha is that pshara adiv, the compromises are better. Now, in a certain sense, following din can bring peace, because what creates bad will between people is when a person feels that he's being cheated, he's being deprived of something that's coming to him. So you go to a Beis Din, a Beis Din is able to figure out what's proper. So it alleviates that tension. And we find, in fact, in Yisrael, where Yisrael is advising Moshe to have a legal system with judges so people could have access to the courts. And he ends his suggestion with, say, Gam kolom azeh al mekomo yabo b'shalom. All these people will come in peace. And the Ramban explains that when a person has a complaint against his friend, but there aren't sufficient judges, so sometimes he'll abandon it. He won't pursue it in court because it's just not worth the hassle and the time and the effort. But he never really forgave his friend. So it creates bad will and creates a lack of shalom. Of course, today that's a big problem. Because going to a certainly in the court system, you can wait years before your case. If the other guy has a decent lawyer, it could be years before your case comes up. And it's very expensive. And even in Beis Din, which generally operates a little more quickly than a court, although you have problems with sometimes with enforcement, it also takes time and costs money, and it's a difficult experience. So it is not unusual, if the case isn't big enough, people say, forget it. What is it? $1,000, $500? You know, it's not worth it to go to the court, not worth it to go to Beis Din. But I'm angry, the guy cheated me $500. So it creates a sin that you go to court and things are resolved, and it creates shalom. In fact, one could see from this Ramban the extent to which this applies, because Yisro's Eitzah was you should have Sari Alofim, Sari Meos, Sari Chamishim, Sari Asaros. He went down so far as to say you have one judge for every 10 people. Now let's say you would have only had one judge for every 50 people. Right, that would be a pretty good system. I know we Jews are kind of a difficult nation. We probably will have more than the average share of D'Souza, although I'm not exactly sure what this is all about in the Midbar. I never got that straight. Where was the business? Like, what was happening? You took my money, I took your money, you couldn't get extra money anyway. So I'm not exactly sure what all the disputes were, but apparently we Jews figured out a way. What? Yeah, we figured out something. But if you didn't have Sari Asaros, what would happen? You know, it wouldn't be very much of a delay. Chances are most of the time you could go to court the moment you wanted to. Once in a while there might be a brief delay. There's one guy ahead of you. What could be? So who's going to abandon a claim because he has to wait an extra day? L'chora, it's only if it's a really small claim. It's a few bucks. All right, you know, I come to court, they're not available. Ah, never mind, I'm not going to come back tomorrow. Even that small amount could create a breakdown in shalom. So it's $5 that he took from me. But it bothers me. And the relationship is not the same. It creates a breakdown in shalom. So even something which is so small that a person would abandon his claim in a day, is still dangerous. Nevertheless, even though din has the capacity to bring shalom, it doesn't always work. Because when din will bring shalom, when the balei din accept the judgment, and they have trust in the judge, and they accept the judgment, and the loser accepts the verdict. But that isn't always the case. I think might have been Reb David that tells the story that he once got involved, he was a Rav, and he got involved with a Din Torah between two Balabatim in his community. So he didn't realize, he said he expected that it could be that the guy who loses will become an enemy of his. But then he found out that they both became enemies. Because the guy who loses becomes his enemy. Later, the two guys made up with each other. So my friend doesn't like the Rav, I don't like the Rav either. But it's not always the case that din brings shalom. Because if the Baal Dabur who loses doesn't accept the judgment, he still feels cheated. So now he's angry at the Dayanim and he's still angry at the other guy. So there is a potential problem in din. So Pshara has a Mila that if you make a compromise and both sides agree, even though they're not entirely happy, but they're not entirely unhappy. And Pshara has the potential in certain cases to bring Shalom more than din. Shlomo HaMelech was big on din. He was able to do it. Even Shlomo HaMelech's din wasn't always accepted. So the Barbanel is saying that it created a certain amount of animosity and a resentment because he was rodef the din, he didn't do pshara. And Shlomo felt that people would trust him and he was able to talk and do the din properly, which he was. But people are people, and even Shlomo Melech is the judge, not every Baal Dabur is going to accept it. And he wasn't mavchin, he didn't make that effort to pursue pshara where it was appropriate. So therefore, there was a complaint. It was one of the three complaints that came to Rechava. I remember a story that I was involved with in my early days in Florida. We had hired a secretary. It didn't really work out because she was very disorganized. And she had a great phone personality, but she couldn't keep things straight. So we got a different secretary, but we're doing our journal campaign, we hired her to do phone solicitations. And it was supposed to be paid by the hour, and we keep records of the hours. So she was very good, and we were very satisfied. The only problem is, she was very disorganized. When she came to submit her hours, I was keeping record of her hours, and she was keeping her records, and they weren't the same. So she had like 15 extra hours or whatever it was. It wasn't a lot of money, but you know, I knew she was wrong. And my attitude was, this is Maman Hektish. Belongs to Yeshiva. I can't give it away improperly. She was very upset, started this whole fight. Started complaining to this one, complaining to that one, wants to take us to Din Torah. Of course, there's a few hundred dollars in the whole thing. So a Rav called me, who had heard from me, says, and asked me what's going on, told him the situation. He says, tell me something. If it was your business, private business, what would you do? So I said, I would pay her off. It's not worth the Agmas Nefesh, the bad name, anything else. So then he said, so just because it's Maman Hektish, the yeshiva has to suffer? I said, you're getting so caught up in the idea. You know, it makes sense. It was better for your business, and it's better for the yeshiva too. But sometimes pshara is better than din. So I'll be din. I think I, maybe I wasn't right, but I think I was right. I'm pretty sure I was. But it's not worth it. She wasn't trying to cheat the yeshiva. She was confused. She probably counted the same hours twice, whatever it was. She's an honest lady. We knew it's probably not worth it to hire her again. That's a different story. But she wasn't trying to do anything. But you know, so now what? So she's going to go complain to everybody in town and this and that, and you know, for the $300. It's not worth it. So the so it's not always is din the best solution. Sometimes you have to be mevater. Sometimes you have to have pshara. What? I can't hear you? Yeah. Now, there's another interesting phrase in this pasuk. You look in the pasuk, the ata, right? The first ata is with an aleph and the second is with an ayin, two different words. Those amongst us who still know how to pronounce an ayin will know they're not pronounced the same. But the ata, and you now, what does this mean now? Why did they just say the ata hakel me'avodas avicha? Why do they have to say now? So there are two explanations I saw in the Mefarshim. The Malbim says that this was really what I guess we would say a dig, an attack or an undercutting of Rechavam. They called him Va'ata, which is, by the way, is not how you address a king. Right? A king is addressed V'Hamelech, third person. You don't say you, Ata, to a king. And then they said, now, what was the implication of now? So the Malbim said, Va'ata, you, saying, don't think that you're a Shlomo. Shlomo did all these things. Shlomo was a great person. Shlomo was a man of vision, leadership, accomplished a great deal, built the base of Mikdash, brought peace and prosperity. For him to do a thing like he did, okay, but you ain't no Shlomo HaMelech. So that this was a dig. This was a cut at him. You're just you. You guy there, you want to be king, maybe we'll serve you, but don't think you're Shlomo HaMelech. What was that line from the old debate? I knew John Kennedy, though you ain't no John Kennedy. So it could be Rechavam was a lot better than John Kennedy, but he wasn't no Shlomo HaMelech. The second thing was saying, Ata is now, says, you haven't done anything yet. Shlomo HaMelech, who had a track record of accomplishment, so after you've done something for us, then you could consider raising the taxes. But you're just coming into office. You haven't done a thing. So first, prove yourself. Show that you could accomplish something. Then we could talk. Then we would consider... that would be such a great system, wouldn't it? Every new administration that comes into power can't tax you until they show that they could do something. But these were the two complaints. Or the two... points that they were trying to cut Rechavam down. Number one, you're not as great as Shlomo HaMelech. And number two, you haven't done anything yet. So now, where are you coming now to charge such high taxes and to be so oppressive? The Kliyaka has a slightly different twist, and it's very interesting according to him. The Kliyaka says that they were not asking for permanent tax relief. They were only asking for temporary reduction. Ba'ata you now, and then later, v'navotcha. So we just came through some really tough times. Give us a reprieve. Give us some time to rebuild, to regroup. And then, if you want, we're willing to go back to the higher burdens and the higher taxes. So all they're asking, according to Kliyaka, was a temporary reprieve. And that actually parallels, we will see, the advice of the Zakenim. What the Zakenim told Rechavam is, if you cut the burden now, they will become loyal to you and you'll be able to raise the burden later and you can do what you want. But if you're tough now, you'll chase them away. So according to the Kliyaka, that's in fact all they asked for. So it heightens again the foolishness, so to speak, of Rechavam's response. Right. If they would have asked for permanent relief, so one could understand that maybe the Atzas HaKenim is risky. You're going to lower the burden now. Who says you'll be able to raise it later? But if all they asked was for a temporary reprieve, then it should be a relatively easy thing to raise it later. So then what are you worried about? Like, why didn't you listen? So we again see the strange decision making, which of course also we say, the Pasuk says clearly that was Minas Shamayim, to end up dividing the Malchus.
How soon after Rechavam became king? Did all this like right away?
Yes.
Like 2 days after?
Basically, yes. This was a very rapid sequence of events. Okay, Pasuk Hey. By Yomar Aleim, and he said to them, Nechu Ot Shloshes Yomim. Wait for another 3 days, or Shuvalan, come back to me. Vayelchu am, and the people left. Why did he ask for 3 days? Because he wanted to consider their request. The Rabag says that we learn a very important lesson from this, that Rechavam's behavior was correct, and the lesson we learn is, don't rush into decisions. Have Yishuv Das, think things through. People often make bad decisions because they panic, they think they have to make decisions immediately. And we often create our own pressures. Sometimes there are situations you have no choice, you have to make decisions, but most of the time you have more time than you think. And it's very important to do things b'yishuv hadas. The Rosh Yeshiva always used to quote, there's a Rashi in the Taz that explains the Rashi, by the Mei Meriva. So Rashi explains, why did Moshe hit the rock? And Kadosh Baruch Hu said to Moshe, speak to the rock. Why in the world would Moshe violate the Tzibui Hashem? So Rashi says that there was an earlier occasion in the Midbar where Moshe was told to get water from a rock, and at that point he was told to hit the rock. Now he was told to speak to the rock. And famous Chazal, he spoke to the rock and nothing happened. That's because the rocks got mixed up. He spoke to the wrong rock, but he didn't know that. So he spoke to the rock and nothing happened. So Moshe made a cheshbon. Moshe said, the last time HaKadosh Baruch Hu told me to get water from a rock, he told me to hit the rock. Now he told me to speak to the rock. What did that mean? It's a lamda sheshaila. Did HaKadosh Baruch Hu mean speak to the rock instead of hitting the rock? Or maybe he meant speak to the rock in addition to hitting the rock. Is it a replacement or is it an addition? So since speaking to the rock alone didn't help, it must be that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted me to do both. So that's why he hit the rock. So comes along the Taz and says, if that's the case, what was the chet? He had a good argument. What did he expect of him? So he has two explanations. The first explanation was the mistake was at step one. He wasn't paying enough attention to which rock it was. So he should have realized that he had the wrong rock, and therefore he had no business making this deduction. He should have spoken to the right rock and see what happens. Okay. Interpretation number two, says the Taz, is that it's true that Moshe had an argument, but he didn't hear that explicitly from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So you can't be 100% sure that you're right. So if you're not 100% sure that you're right, then you should wait. Why are you in such a big rush? Maybe HaKadosh Baruch Hu will clarify it. Maybe something will happen. Maybe the water will start coming, who knows? So don't rush to a decision, even though you have a logic, you have an argument, but if you can't be sure that your argument is correct, you don't rush to a decision. So Rosh Yeshiva pointed out, look what's happening. People are coming saying that they're dying of thirst. They need water. So Moshe Rabbeinu says, Shimon Amorim, because Rosh is going to take care of you. Why are you rebelling? Watch! Here comes the water. No water. 3 million people standing there. No, Moshe, where's the water you promised? What's your rush? Imagine the pressure on Moshe Rabbeinu. But Sof Kosof, if I wait another 2 minutes, are the stones flying? Have they started charging? Everyone's still standing around. There's some time. Do you ever stand around and wait for something, you know, like really to happen? You know how long every second takes?
But maybe using the more of even though you wait till the person died of hunger. Well, you don't think that you
more. Okay, you have to get it right. You shouldn't wait longer. If there is a need for immediate action, you do have to act. But people feel pressure to act when there is no need. Because Sof Kosof here, maybe it was only another minute that he had, another 2 minutes. But you did have 2 minutes. They weren't going to die. So he, there was a taina Moshe Rabbeinu, too hasty. And therefore you should have relied on your judgment. So you got to be calm, got to keep equilibrium. You've got to make sure that you do things in b'mesinus. I remember also, we had a circumstance once where we had in the school in Florida. I know in New York we wouldn't get away with this, but Florida is still out of town. Our preschool, we had two what would be here called pre-1A classes, but they weren't divided boys and girls. They were divided by age, the younger kids and the older kids. When we get to first grade, we separated boys and girls. 1 year, among the thing, the class was predominantly boys. And at that time, it was before we had bought our new building, we had been renting facilities. There were 30 boys in the class.